Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I made the mistake of looking at Homebridge this morning.
That's never good. If you're looking at Homebridge, it's because something, either you need to add something or there's a problem generally. And then other times it's just like, that thing's running. Let's check that out.
I look forward to our Matter future where all smart home devices just talk to one another and you don't have to do things like run janky software in order to bridge so that my Nest thermostat shows up in HomeKit because I would like it to interact with the rest of my devices. And so I have to run Homebridge to do that. I know there are other alternatives too, but I had Homebridge set up so long ago that I just...
The dumb one for me is always things like outlets where it's like, really? You couldn't make your outlet that just turns things on and off work with HomeKit. We really had to go through a third-party plugin to make that all work.
Yeah, and I mean, you can buy new outlet things that don't require that, but that is money that it's like, but this works.
Yeah, it works just fine. Why would I replace that? Yeah, I'm very hopeful about Matter, but I also feel at the same time very trepidatious about it because I somehow feel that I will still end up replacing a bunch of the stuff I have. Yeah. I'm not sure how well the backwards compatibility will work. That's my question. It's like, well, if I have super old devices, they won't obviously get to take advantage of everything, probably, but in theory they should work. I don't know. It's a big question
for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would be nice if I could unplug some of my little wireless
the
boxes.
Hubs.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, they're all next to me in the office because that's where there's a switch to plug them in. I was going to say that I think the key thing is that the sort of hand in hand with this is the move and sort of additional, like, more and more devices adopting Thread, which I think is probably even a bigger improvement in some ways. But that is a case where it really is like, well, you'll have to replace things if you want it to take advantage of all the things that Thread can do, because you need a chip for that, right? Like, so if you got a HomePod Mini, you can work as a Thread hub, but if your devices don't support Thread, then they won't get all the nifty things. And I thought about this in particular with I've been meaning actually to write this up for Six Colors. I don't remember if we talked about it before, but I bought a smart lock, and I like it a lot, except for the fact that Bluetooth is just a terrible protocol, and using it for things is janky sometimes. So, like, you know, it does the auto unlock thing, you know, based on a geofence and Bluetooth and stuff like that. And it often works pretty well, but sometimes you just, you know, you're a little faster than Bluetooth can handle. And you go to open the door and you're like, the door's still locked. And then sometimes I'll pull out my phone and like hold it up to where the smart lock is. And then it will be like, oh, there's your phone. Sure, I'll unlock now. And it's like, well, that's not that much more efficient than me having a key at this point.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it my experience with smart locks has definitely been, it's great when they work, and then, but you can't expect it. Like with mine, it's very much, hey, it auto unlocked, that's great, and then sometimes it's like, oh, I'll put in the code now on the keypad, because
mine doesn't even have a keypad because it goes inside the lock.
Which
is nice, because on the outside, it doesn't appear to be a smart lock. You would not know from looking at it.
Right.
It is a normal deadbolt, but there is a level bolt inside of it that has like a little motor and a Bluetooth and stuff like that. But yeah, it would be super cool if it used Thread and or ultra wideband, you know, for that kind of stuff. It won't work, presumably, with the new stuff that Apple's added into the wallet, where you can put your keys in your wallet, for example. I don't think it would work with that because it needs different hardware, but... It's cool.
Yeah.
It's a cool device.
I'm holding out to the use of this smart lock until it either gets updated or there's a new one that supports that stuff, right? Because that's what I really want, is I want to be able to touch my phone or my watch to the door and just have it open.
Right.
But we're not there yet.
Not
Bluetooth. The Bluetooth stuff, it's just, it's not, I mean, it's kind of not what Bluetooth was made for. But
exactly. It's a bit hacky.
Yeah. Anyway, I ended up in there today, cause I wrote a little thing cause I thought, I mean, I went down a rabbit hole of home automation stuff because Quinn Nelson, tweeted about his cat turning on his HomePod in the middle of the night. And the one response that I thought was great, like people were like, well, there's an accessibility. Well, some people are like, put a cover over it. It's like, okay. there's an accessibility setting that makes you have to hold down the thing for, like, you can make it like many seconds before it does anything,
right,
which is fine, but then you also have to do that. But you can't lock it out completely, but you could make it so it's effectively locked out unless the cat lays on your HomePod. But somebody said that they had this problem, and it brilliant solution, which is they made a home automation that sets HomePod volume to zero, like at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought
that is smart.
That's super good use of a home automation. And then you could, at 7 a.m, you could set it back up to 30% or whatever,
right,
and find out if your cat turned it on in the night. But it would only, you'd only hear about it then.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it's funny. I wrote up a while back that I had an automation I was using to do, you know, essentially turn on the Sonos in our bedroom in the morning with the news when we were, when it's time to get up. And I ended up actually switching it from the home app as an automation to Sonos. It turned out has a built-in alarm feature, which I thought was very interesting. And for me, the reason was twofold. One, it had a couple features that were better than the way the home automation does it. For example, when you set the volume level, it actually gives you a percentage reading as you drag it, right? It tells you, like, oh, this is 12% volume, this is 15% volume, etc. And what I found was that the home app does not tell you that. It's just a slider, and you kind of have to guess, and then you have to test it. And what turns out is that you sometimes think is a very reasonable volume while you're testing it in the middle of the day when it wakes you up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you're like,
not reasonable.
That's too loud. That's too loud. And then you're like, I need to set it like one percentage down, but you can't do that because there's no, it doesn't tell you, right? You have to get, was that lower? Because it's so close to the bottom of the thing in terms of the way the scale of volume is that it's like, I may have moved it lower. I may have also just moved it higher. It's really difficult to tell. So that was better implemented there, and Apple should do a better job of that. But the other thing was a reliability thing, and that's because the way it works kind of dumbly, and this ties into something you and Mike talked about this week on Upgrade, is, you know, it can't access the Sonos directly. So it's running a shortcut. And then it's essentially airplaying from a HomePod to the Sonos speaker, which is so weird. So if I look at it, it will tell me like, oh, it's playing kitchen to bedroom to play this audio. And I'm like, why? It's like, well, you can't control the Sonos directly. The music has to, you know, the audio has to come from somewhere. And it's it coming from the HomePod because that's where the automation was running and then playing to the speaker.
Yeah.
And I just, and sometimes it wouldn't work because AirPlay, as you guys discussed, is sometimes unreliable.
Mm.
So it turned out that the Sonos thing, where it's just built in, like, just Sonos, you handle that, works great. It is like, I have never had it fail, basically. So, you know, a couple other things that are just, you know, it's a, I love that the automation stuff is there, but it is, it is kind of janky and often feels like maybe people aren't using it that much, so it's not getting updated or getting the features it really needs to have. And I don't remember if this is true. Like, one of the other things the Sonos one it does, which is nice, and I'm not sure if you can do this in the home automation or not, is it also, you can tell it a time to turn off. So, like, if I have it come on at 7, I can have it turn off at 8, just in case, like, we both left the room or something and forgot
right
about it.
Most home automations have a,
I think there might
you
be,
you know, turn the, undo this after a certain amount of time, and you can, because I just set up a home automation this week for, it's the winter home automation, which is, I've got a dehumidifier in our bedroom, and there's a humidity sensor so that if it trips over a certain percentage, it the dehumidifier goes on and the fan starts to turn. And it's not, I got to work on it because it's not entirely reliable, because threshold stuff, you have to use the Home Plus app. You can't use the Home app. And it's, so it's a third party app, and it's, yeah, you know, it's kind of a little shaky, but one of its options is like, would you like me to just, once I turn this on, should I just like turn it off 4 hours later, right?
Right.
It's like, yeah,
there is
valuable.
I double checked and it is in there. I just hadn't had it set up at the time, but yeah,
that's nice.
So it is an option. But it's, yeah, there's a lot of little things like this, and we've talked obviously a lot about shortcuts and stuff where it feels like, you know, hopefully it's still under development. One of the other things that I thought is wild is like the action for, I was trying to get it to like turn on my Apple TV as part of an automation, and if you, like, there was an only an option in the home op, basically it mostly treats tapping on like an Apple TV that shows up there as like play, which is not the best choice sometimes. So again, it feels like I love the idea of integrating, and it has the Apple TV and the HomePods and stuff integrated there, but I often wish in the Home app that there were better controls for interacting with them in the Home app. Like, in some ways, it feels like that would help solve some of the issues that, you know, bedevil me, that I think you guys were also talking about the differences between AirPlaying and controlling speakers, which I find incredibly irritating. Yeah. It's everything about that experience is worse than it should be.
That's what I was really complaining to Mike about on Upgrade this week, is that thing. And I had a person really trying to help me who was like, oh, did you know that there's this keyboard thing to control Sonos from your Mac keyboard, but he missed the point that the keyboard commands only get lost when you're in that control mode, which you can't do to a Sonos speaker. You can only do that to a HomePod. So it's not an option to the Sonos speakers I have. I went back. I was playing music and audio stuff, like podcasts and music, yesterday while I was cleaning out my office on my Sonos speakers, and I'm still not convinced that the HomePod minis are any more stable. I think
I agree.
This is an AirPlay problem.
I agree. One thing I tend to like about the Sonos better is that it doesn't have that disparity between, is this playing on the HomePod or is this being AirPlayed from my phone to the HomePod, because it can't do that. So I'm like, well, that's much easier. And it makes it easier because there's cases where you start playing. I will play a podcast. I will move it to like, oh, I'm going to go listen in the kitchen while I do dishes. And then when I come back to my phone, it's out of sync from where it was. Like, because it's been handed off to the HomePod. The HomePod played 20 more minutes, and when I go back to my phone, it's 20 minutes in the past. And this is using Apple's own podcast app, which are supposed to sync and remember where you are, and it very frequently does not for me. So I find that it's just, you know, that makes me hold my head a bit and be like, why do I now have to fast forward 20 minutes and try and find where I was?
You know, one of the things I like about the Sonos over the HomePods, now that I've got them both here and I've been using them kind of to compare, and I wrote about it a little bit, but the one that I really like is I can put the two Sonos speakers on opposite sides of my room, and I'm a little bit closer to the left. I'm actually a lot closer to the left than the right. And Sonos, you can actually go into the settings and say, change the balance of a stereo pair.
Oh, yeah.
So one is louder and one is quieter, because I really want it to sound even where I sit, even though one of them is much further away than the other one. And the HomePods don't do that.
I will notice this a lot, because I will be doing, so I have like PT exercises I do for some shoulder problems, and I will sit at my desk in my office, and there is a HomePod about 2 feet, no, a little further than that, 3-4 feet to my right on like a little table. And then the other one in the stereo pair is probably more like 6 or 7 feet, and they're also kind of on a diagonal, like, just because they're where the door is, I can't have it like strictly left to right, so it's like back too. And I will notice, because I'll be doing something like sitting in my chair, and then I'll get up and walk over to the door frame to use that for an exercise, and I can hear the like source moving, right? Like, I can hear, I've been listening to it on the right one, and as I move over to the other side of the room, I'm like, oh, it's definitely all coming, like, now I'm getting it from this other one, because I'm much closer to that one now. So it doesn't have quite that seamlessness that I think that Apple always kind of envisioned for the stereo mix, because they're not like perfectly lined up. And it's supposed to, you know, they, I think, claimed they could sort of correct for that, but I don't think it really does. And like you said, they don't let people tweak it at all.
Yeah.
The Sonos ones are really good, because I have a pair of Play ones as rear speakers along with the Sonos Arc in my living room. And they're not perfectly lined up either, but you can even tell it in the app, like, where is this? How close is this speaker to you? Is it less than 2 feet? Is it 2 to 6 feet? Is it farther than 6 feet? And you can set that independently for the various ones. So you don't even like, and I think it even has other things that you can tweak it, but if you just want to be generally like, oh yeah, this is where this one is, and this one where this is, and it figures it out. And I found that pretty reliable, actually.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think this HomePod, the thing about the HomePods is that it's weird for an Apple product, but like, they're cheaper than the Sonos is, because if there's a company that can battle it out with Apple in terms of expensive equipment, it's Sonos. The HomePods are cheaper, and although they don't sound as good, they sound okay. They sound pretty good if you're, you know, again, I get feedback from people who are like, well, you really should have a pair of an amp and wired speakers. That's the solution to your problem. It's like, no, my problem is that I don't want wires. So yeah. Wired speakers are not a solution to my problem, because those people are saying your problem is that you really want the highest quality audio setup for your workspace. Yes. And the answer is I don't. I appreciate a good high quality audio setup. I don't want the highest quality audio setup for my workspace. I want to be able to play music while I'm working. I'm not actively listening to the music. I'm playing familiar music and it's playing in the background. And occasionally I'll crank it up if I'm really enjoying a particular song. And that's all I want. And my point about the HomePod Mini is it works for that. Like my office is not a small space. It's a garage. It's a two-car garage, half of a two-car garage, essentially. But the HomePod Mini turned up all the way, we'll fill it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most loud I ever needed to be. And for the price, it's actually pretty good. Like I actually think it's a pretty good value, and works pretty well. And if you're willing to just sort of like use the HomePod to drive it instead of having, you know, control on your Mac and stuff where I'm having my frustrations, it actually works fairly well. And while the Sonos speakers are better and you absolutely have better options, to have little tiny things that you can stick in a couple of places, or even, I mean, honestly, the bass is not so strong that you can't put them on your desk. It's not going to really rattle your desk either. It's a pretty good, I mean, I think they're pretty good, even though for my particular use case, since I already have these Sonos speakers that I bought, they are better. So I guess I will use them. But if I didn't have them, I wouldn't buy them. I would just use the HomePods because they're cheaper and they're fine.
I bought a pair of wired speakers for my computer because I had an old set that were courtesy Dan Frakes, and then they like from way back in the day, and they were a nice set of Voltec Lansings, but like they were starting to buzz, and I was like, this is a pain to track down. They were a 2.1 set, so they had a giant subwoofer that sat on the floor next to my desk. And the other problem was that because of where the subwoofer was and the fact that the cable plugged into that was just like a mini jack cable that plugged into the iMac, I have a sit-stand desk, and every time I tried to lift it, it would pull that taut, and I was like, this is annoying. I could get a longer cable, but like I said, they're old, they're starting to like, you know, show their age a bit. And so I went on and I bought, like, based on, you know, probably a Wirecutter recommendation, like a pair of, like, you know, desktop just left and right channel speakers, and like, oh, you know, like $150 or something, maybe less than that, maybe it's 100 actually for the ones I bought. It's like, that's a pretty reasonable cost. These are nice looking speakers. They arrived and ended up being, first of all, bigger than I thought. Not terrible, but like they're like bookshelf speaker sized. And then as I realized after I hooked them up, and they have fewer wires than the old one, which is nice. Like they do have to connect to each other and plug in and then plug into the computer, which is a lot of wires, but it's fewer than the ones that had the subwoofer and an extra little control element for the old Altec Lansing ones. But they're actually reference monitors. So the sound on them is way better than what I need them for, which is usually editing podcasts, because that's the one thing I can't do on wireless speakers because the latency is too high.
Exactly.
So I literally have a pair of wired speakers for that. Occasionally I'll listen to music on it, but mostly it's just for editing audio or listening to like a YouTube video when I don't want to wear my headphones or something. But yeah, it's not, it's probably overkill.
Overkill, for sure.
But oh well.
Everybody has their choices. It's fine. It's fine. I appreciate good sounding speakers. It's just that I have come to realize that there's a threshold in my office above which I like.
Good enough.
The iMac Pro's internal speaker is not good. I mean, it's usable and I use it for podcast editing now, but it's not good enough. It's fine. It's not good enough. But like HomePod Minis or the Sonos Ones, like they're good enough. Like they're good enough.
Right.
I'm in this context, I would not say they're good enough for my living room, but I'm not in my living room. So, computers and homes and things. I spent a lot of time this week because, you know, things are calming down. I spent a lot of time thinking about user automations because I'm just kind of into shortcuts stuff right now just because it's new And it's changing. I mean, it's changing beta by beta, but it's new and interesting, and finding new interesting Mac things, especially something that's user automation, really hits the spot. So John Voorhees at Mac Stories and I have kind of been going back and forth with posting all these things about Mac shortcuts. And I did a thing about the command line, and I got John's shortcut that makes Apple scripts that run shortcuts into a one-line terminal command, which was kind of a fun diversion. It's all kind of up in the air. Like, they're not wrong when they say that this is the beginning of a long process. It's basically a beta. It's fun to play with it, but there are so many of the things, like what John is doing and what I have wrote about this week, what I wrote about, are things that are very obviously just patching holes that Apple will fill one day, right? We're not at the point of like, oh, here's a thing you can do. It's more like, hey, I built this thing to fix this thing that will very obviously be filled in by Apple at some point.
Right.
But it's a hole right now. And those are, you know, you can tell. It's like, of course they have to come up with a solution for this. But in the meantime, you can write scripts that run like literally it's an Apple script, that a one line Apple script that runs a shortcut, because some places, some apps don't know how shortcuts work, but they can run a script. So you run a script that runs the shortcut. It's really dumb. That clearly has to be changed, but that's where we are right now.
Yeah, it is. It's nice that the ability exists, right? Like, to work around stuff. Whereas in the past, it feels like that was not really a facility that was often available, or with some of the automation tools that were available, it was either too complex or just didn't really work. I'm like, again, thinking of AppleScript and Automator stuff. It's like AppleScript, well, you got to learn AppleScript, and AppleScript is not very user friendly. Nope. Or Automator, which also I always had trouble with, like, either didn't quite do what I wanted, or I couldn't figure out how to make it do it.
And
I
thought were really limited.
Shortcuts is certainly better on a lot of those fronts, though it also still has its own peculiarities. I got your reference when you told Mike about the shortcut phantom zone, where stuff shows up, and I was like, yep, I understand exactly what you're talking about. Shortcuts does this thing, and it's like, I did that thing. Well, where is it? Oh, you didn't tell me to put it somewhere.
Yeah.
You just told me to do it.
Yeah.
I did it. It was in my head.
I get it, but it's not what you're thinking, especially if you've dealt with other kinds of automation. Yeah, that moment, that was such a great moment when I was like, where did the I'm unarchiving a zip file in a shortcut. Where did it go? And I finally, after searching and searching, I realized it didn't go anywhere because it doesn't exist. It's like Schrodinger's cat. Right. Until it is observed, it doesn't exist. Or, okay, that's not what Schrodinger's cat is. But you say, we don't know whether it's dead or alive. Well, the zip archive is like, okay, you unarchived the zip folder or the zip file, but until you put it somewhere, it isn't anywhere. Ah, what is that?
It's like your math teacher asking you to do a math problem, and you do it in your head and you don't say anything. And you're like, yeah, I did it.
I did it.
I added those numbers in my head. Want me to tell you what the answer is?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's...
That was just such a... But I think that's one of the things that makes shortcuts good, is it's not... The AppleScript model was an application scripting language, right? Like, the whole idea is although there's stuff that's not... When you say AppleScript's hard to learn... I think the truth is that a lot of AppleScript is actually easy to learn. All the control stuff of like for loops and if then else statements, those are all fine.
But interacting with apps, which is what you want to do.
That's it, right? So the basic language is okay. The problem is that every app has its own dictionary, which means while they say, oh, AppleScript, you know, it's a human... I mean, they don't say this anymore, but in the 90s, it was like, oh, you write it like you would write a sentence in English.
Right.
It's like, but imagine... So every app has its own dictionary. That means every app basically has its own way of interacting with things that is the only app that does it that way. And so you have to learn, like, once I cracked how to script FileMaker or Eudora or something like that back in the day, I could do whatever I wanted. But there was this enormous hurdle, which was how to learn how that app, and the dictionaries are impenetrable, so you really need to find scripts that work with it and then see how they're written and then rip them off in order to do
right.
what they
yeah,
do.
I mean,
and that was my bigger point is that AppleScript is also remote controlling applications based. The whole premise of it is it's here for you to script apps and weld them together. And it's incredibly powerful for that. And Shortcuts, because I think of necessity, because it came from iOS, Shortcuts is about sort of like doing stuff. And then some of that stuff, like Automator was supposed to be like this too, and some of that stuff is lent to it from apps, but like it's not. So on the Mac, you use the Finder to move the files around, and then you unzip them and you do all of that. And in Shortcuts, like Shortcuts says, no, I'll just do it. Now, maybe it's because there's no Finder in iOS, so it had to do it. But the net result is it's got this capability where it's a little more freestanding, and I think it benefits from it.
Yeah. No, I mean, essentially cobbling together things from other people's like scripts and automations and stuff is how you learn.
That's how we learn.
Like any programming language.
HTML and everything.
I was messing about with writing a Discord bot, and I basically I basically started like teaching myself Python to do that and be like, all right,
welcome.
I'm going to take somebody else's script, figure out how to adapt that to what I want to do. And then, that was a weird experience. But yeah, that's how we learned how to do programming stuff. Most programmers I've talked to, they learned by taking apart what somebody else had done, figuring out why it worked, and then figuring out how to change it.
And Googling for the answer and finding a line of code on Stack
Overflow. It was tougher before there was Google, for sure. But yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I still do that. The problem with using an old language like AppleScript is that the Google results are not as good. Although they're surprisingly good, but they're not as good as when I started learning Python. I was like, oh, literally every answer has been answered 1,000 times. And with AppleScript, it's like there's like 3 sites that have the answer, and you got to click through and find the right little detail. That's not a problem with a modern programming language. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's always fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the other thing I did this week is the Kobo Kindle thing. Gruber, of all the stories, I didn't expect this to happen. Gruber linked to my story about the 3 e-readers on Daring Fireball. I was just surprised by that. I didn't expect that. He surprises me sometimes, which is very nice. I'm happy. I like doing that. I like covering that category. It's relatively low volume, so it's fairly easy to cover, and it's a category I care about, and there's not a lot of people paying attention to it, so that's all good. Mm-hmm. But what I discovered was that a lot of people took this aside I made, and I've mentioned this a couple of times, and they've misunderstood it, which is when I say Kobo's better than Kindle at library books. And everybody who has a Kindle is like, hey, wait a minute, what are you saying? I can do library books just fine, which is not what I said. I said Kobo's better at it. And I realized that there was this real gap between people's conception of what's good, especially coming from people who are like Apple users and Mac users, where it's like, you should know, like, there's acceptable and then there's good. And the Kindle version of library stuff is sort of like the Windows of library stuff. Like, it works.
Yeah, it just requires
And if you have no other frame of reference to imagine that there could be something better, you'd be like, okay, this is fine. And it's better than it used to be. You can go to Libby, which is a great app, and you can say deliver to Kindle. I detailed this in a post this week. And then it opens a web view to Amazon, and you pick what Kindle you want to send it to, and you press deliver, and it loads a page that says, it's delivered. And then when you sync your Kindle, boom, you get the library book. And you can even return it from the Kindle, which you couldn't used to do, so yay. Except on Kobo, and so this is why I wrote this post, and I took a bunch of screenshots, had to figure out how to take screenshots on e-readers. Not obvious. Because I wanted to show people, like, no, you don't understand. You can literally see the books that you've reserved on the device. You can literally see what books are coming on the device. You can search for a book at your local library and check it out on the device. And a lot of people were like, yeah, I like using Libby on my iPhone. I was like, well, great. It's a great app. You should. But there is something to be said for you're sitting reading a book, and you get to the end and you're like, oh, what am I going to read next? And being able to maybe search for the next book in the series right there and check it out. Or even if you're looking at their store, you can tap the little pop-up in the Kobo store. And if it's available at your library, it'll be like, reserve this on Overdrive right there. So you don't even need to buy it. You just check it out from the library. Like, it's completely integrated. Unsurprising, because the company that owns Kobo owned Overdrive for like 5 years. So it's super integrated, but it's good. And so I wrote that post. It was literally like, I want a post to link to when somebody says, but what do you mean that Kobo's experience is better than Kindle? And it's like, Well, I said that because I didn't want to explain it all again. Now I can hyperlink. I'll be like, that's what I mean. Yeah. It's better. It's nicer. That's all.
We talked on Slack about this, and I mentioned like the one wrinkle I have with Kobo is like dealing with if you have multiple libraries.
Yes,
and you can make it work.
You can,
but it is not obvious. It took me a while of like Googling and figuring out how to do that, and like the steps you had to take, because you have to like link things with your Overdrive account, and then eventually you can get it to work, but yep, it is a bit of a pain, and it feels like that's a place where Overdrive and Kobo could maybe improve that, but it's still, again, like you said, it's still better.
So the one that makes me laugh, because the Kobo implementation is actually similar to Kindle's implementation in that what they're really doing is the book is in their library for sale, and their own collection of content that they sell. And then they get a license from Overdrive, and then they vend you the book from their store. So when you return the book, you get like a sample. It's marked in your account as one of your books, but you don't own it. So they've made it like you asked for a sample, which is this weird, like, I can understand why from a database perspective, if you're trying to hack libraries into an existing store infrastructure, you'd do it this way. And they both do it that way. So that's funny, but there's a side effect of that Lauren and I have discovered, which is she's got a Kobo logged in with my Kobo account, so she can see all the stuff that I buy, but logged into a different library than the library I'm logged into, and my books show up on her Kobo, and hers show up on mine, because we're on the same Kobo account, even though our library accounts right now are set to different libraries. It's bananas, but I mean, it's fine, but it's just a funny little quirk. So
that is very strange.
It's, you know, it's fine. I was glad. I like ebooks, and you should patronize your local library. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
I was at least glad, and I shouldn't mention this anywhere too public, but I was at least glad I was reading something on the Kobo, and
it's
it was out in the library.
It's just between us.
Yeah, it's just us. And I was like, I'm not going to finish. This is a super long book. I'm not going to finish it like in time. And on like the Kindle, it's always been very easy to just be
put it in airplane mode. Yeah.
I actually found that worked on the Kobo too for me. Like when I turned off the network, I was like, oh, thank God, because I really did not want to have to get this again.
There's two kinds of rights management, right? There's the rights management that phones home and says, is this thing expired? And there's the rights management that has the expiry date
built in, and
it just self-destructs. I think because you can renew and stuff like that, maybe it's just that they decided to be customer friendly and not put that in there, even if the license holder, the publisher, might demand that they do.
Easier to implement.
Maybe there's some obscurity happening there, but yeah, that's true. You can put it in airplane mode, and it won't phone home, and then you can finish your book.
It's good. I want to take advantage of anything, but man, sometimes the wait times, you get a book and you're like, okay, I was reading a book. It was like a fantasy book that was 500, 600 pages or something. I was like, I cannot read this in 2 weeks. I do not have time.
You don't have to tell me. I read Gnomon as a library book by Nick Harkaway. That's a 1,000-page book, folks. Wow. And I had 21 days to read it. And you know what? I did it. I feel like I accomplished something.
You buckled down.
Whew. Every waking moment that I had a spare couple of minutes for a book, I was in that book because I was going to get that book finished. Yeah.
That's a good goal.
So that's, libraries are good. You should patronize
your
libraries.
Support your local libraries.
So a note for Six Colors Podcast listeners. If you enjoy this podcast, tune in to Upgrade on Monday.
Yeah.
Because it's going to basically be this podcast, but more structured. Because Mike's on assignment in Hawaii. By the way, I've seen
the pictures of Mike on assignment, and let me tell you.
By the way, there are a bunch of tech people who are on assignment in Hawaii this week because
I thought Joe was there too.
Yeah, that's true. Qualcomm is having their annual junket, which is in Hawaii every year, right after Thanksgiving.
I get invited to that one.
And I almost managed it this year. It didn't happen, but I almost managed it. And that would have been pretty funny to spend a week in Kona where, you know, basically the days are yours. And then in the evenings they have, or the late afternoons, they have their like press conferences and all that. But I just wanted to chuckle because it's just so hilarious and transparent. And you get all of these analysts and thought leader type people who are like, oh yes, I'm standing on the beach thinking about Qualcomm. sure.
That's what I do when I'm in Hawaii, even when there's not a junket.
Yeah.
I think about Qualcomm
as much as possible. Well, it's beach reading, really. Just read some white papers. Think about ARM specs. I mean, the irony is that Qualcomm is based in San Diego. They could bring people to San Diego. It would be pretty nice, but it's not Hawaii.
It really isn't. Yeah.
I love that they do that. I find it hilarious. And that is
pretty great.
Our friend Philip Michaels has been a bunch of times. He didn't go this time. He's covering it from his house this time, which
it's a little different.
I think that's too bad, but for him, because it's a great thing to do that. But
I'm trying to remember if I ever went to any really interesting places for a press junket. I mean, like, I think I went to New York once. That was probably about it.
That's about it. Well, Barcelona, yeah. I went one year to Mobile World Congress. That was pretty sweet.
Never did the overseas thing.
It's beautiful. That was a good one. But I did a bunch of IDG stuff where we went to IDG International Data Group. They had all of their like global things. Once you get to the level of being an editor-in-chief type, you get invited to those things. And so that was that door unlocked, and all of a sudden I was like, we're going to Copenhagen. Okay, we're going to Dublin, Ireland. All right. We're going to Sweden. Fair enough, right? Like, it's not bad. Berlin. I also went to Berlin. Berlin, Copenhagen, Stockholm.
It's pretty good.
Dublin. And Toronto. Also went to Toronto. And those were every other year. And then on the off year, it was Boston. Woo! yeah. Sorry.
Feels like
Boston.
That's fine. I'm here all the time.
There was grousing the year that we went to Toronto because people were like, are you trying to save money here? I was like, Toronto was fine. Toronto was just
perfectly
fine.
Nice. I tell you, I was in Ottawa this past weekend, and Toronto is way better than Ottawa.
Yeah.
Even people from Ottawa will agree.
Sorry, Ottawa.
Ottawa.
And Montreal, of course.
And Montreal, which I drove through. I got to tell you, Jason, in order to get to Ottawa, you have to go through Montreal more or less. And on the way back,
Did you buy some bagels?
I did. I found a place to stop. My wife found it like the normal place that we go, which is St. Viator's, which is like over downtown.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, that's a little bit far. But it turned out they had like in this outpost in like the, not quite suburbs, but like on the outskirts of Montreal, there was like this little like grocery store that had within it a St. Viator's bakery. And I was like, well, we're stopping there. And Kat's like, it's only 5 minutes out of the way. I was like, great. So we stopped there and I bought like 3 half dozens of bagels. And then they're like, oh, we only take cash. And unfortunately, it turned out my wife had a $20 Canadian bill that one of her Canadian friends had given her as a joke, and she had left in her wallet for like 2 years. Huh. And so it was just enough to buy three half dozens.
18 Montreal bagels.
18 bagels.
You're freezing them?
Oh, yeah. They're frozen. I'm eating them. Nice. I eat one fresh, of course, because they're the best when they're
so good.
You just eat one. You don't even need to put anything on it. I just eat a bagel. And it was like the first time my wife actually bought me some during the pandemic because they will ship them internationally.
Uh-huh.
And it was great, but they're not as good. They're not fresh, right?
No. So if you've never, by the way, if you've never had a Montreal bagel, they're not like New York bagels.
No.
They're different and they're great.
Yeah, there's a place down the street from us that nominally makes Montreal style bagels. They're not as good.
Yeah,
I have to say,
I've made them myself.
They don't quite nail it,
and they're good homemade. But you know, again, I'm not.
You also probably don't have like a wood fired brick oven, which is also
I don't. Although like, I've thought actually about using the Uni
pizza oven
for it. I might do that sometime.
That'd probably be good.
Make some bagels in the hot pizza oven. I don't know. Anyway, we're talking about bagels now. We probably won't do that on Upgrade on Monday.
Probably not.
I mean, you know, who can tell? We didn't know we were going to do it today, but there it is. We did it. All right. Well, I'll talk to you Monday.
I guess so.
Dan, but until then, bye.
Bye, Jason.